harm reduction had to create an evidence base to say that naloxone actually worked and that bystanders, people who didn't have any, quote, medical training, could reverse an overdose. We obviously have safe supply in the case of many legal pharmaceuticals. When harm reduction is when people are beginning to see practices and patterns start to show up, we should listen to them rather than painting everything as if it's a national epidemic.
You're listening to Narcotica, a podcast giving you the straight dope about drugs and the people who use them.
Naloxone is a miracle drug. Calling any drug a miracle can be super problematic, but admittedly there are a few of them, in my opinion. Penicillin, insulin, mifepristone and misoprostol, Thorazine, Viagra, and yes, naloxone. I think it qualifies as a miracle drug, something that works so well, it is astonishing. So many people fought so hard and for so long to have access to naloxone. It wasn't always so available like it is in some places today. When administered, it can reverse an opioid overdose that literally feels like bringing someone back from the dead. They go from not breathing and blue-faced to awake, talking, and maybe not in a good mood, but alive. But the way that we are treating opioid overdose antagonists is changing. Many companies have price gouged their way into profiting and exploiting a vulnerable population. They are bringing in naloxone analogs that they claim are more effective without much evidence, but they do have serious side effects. And because the drug supply is only getting more and more unpredictable, with many non-opioids entering the mix like xylazine and benzo analogs, naloxone may not help with overdoses of this kind. How can we navigate this shifting landscape? I'm Troy Farah, and you're listening to Narcotica. Our guest today is Nancy D. Campbell, author of the books Discovering Addiction and OD, Naloxone and the Politics of Overdose. She is a historian of science who studies addiction research and treatment at RPI in Troy, New York, including at the U.S. Narcotic Farm in Lexington, Kentucky. But first, I want to tell you a little bit about Narcotica. We're aware we haven't put out many episodes in 2023, but Narcotica is not dead, and we have no intention of retiring this show. Like NPR and other podcasts, we are an independent, listener-supported program. We couldn't do this without you. That sounds like hyperbole, that sounds like something every podcast says, but it's 100% true, and we are deeply grateful for all of you. Thank you. If you want to join a few other dozen people who keep this show on the air, we have a Patreon precisely for that at patreon.com/narcotica. We will mail you some stickers if you specifically request it. We also have a store at narcocast.myshopify.com with mugs and t-shirts and cool stuff like that. More info and everything is available at narcocast.com. You can find us on iTunes, Spotify, and social media like Twitter and Facebook. And that's all the boring stuff. Thanks for listening. Now on to the show. Nancy, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Also joining us is Narcotica co-host Chris Maraff, beaming in from Kensington, Philadelphia. How are you doing?
Hey, Troy. Doing good. Nancy, let's start a little bit with your background. It's an interesting field you're in. Would you describe yourself as a historian who graduated towards the issue of addiction and overdose prevention, or were you a harm reductionist that decided to apply a historical lens to something you were already passionate about?
Well, that's a pretty interesting question. I actually started doing this work back in 1990. And although there were harm reductionists at that time, it was not yet a wide enough movement to really show up for me. And so I did become a historian, but somebody who thinks more. I actually went to this crazy graduate program called the History of Consciousness at University of California, Santa Cruz. And it's really more why we think what we think about X. And so in my case, it was why we think what we think about drugs, drug users, and in particular, the war on drugs. I was really interested in the time, in how the war on drugs could manifest in so many different and often quite contradictory ways. And so that got me interested and down a path about U.S. drug policy. But my first job as a historian, was in a women's studies department. So I wrote a whole bunch about gender and addiction. And then I got curious about the U.S. narcotic farm. And that place in the history of science and medicine, of drug use, and particularly of morphine and heroin and opioid use, was very important scientifically. And so then I kind of became a historian of science and medicine. I studied that place. It was a very contradictory place also, just like U.S. drug policy. It was mostly a huge clinical facility off in 1,000 acres of bluegrass country in Lexington, outside of Lexington, Kentucky. But it also had this very tiny scientific laboratory called the Addiction Research Center, the ARC. And it was that laboratory that was really producing the world's knowledge of what the science of, say, morphine abstinence was. What did it really look like to go through withdrawal? What happened neurophysiologically to people? And so I got very interested in the ARC, and partly I think it's because it was an important place of its own, because they had to really actually talk to and listen to drug users in order to do their science. And so I got interested in what kind of knowledge did drug users have to share with these scientists and these doctors, and how did they influence the shape of the history? So I've always been interested in where's the voice of the drug user in science and medicine. And so that has been kind of my entree into the harm reduction movement, because harm reductionists in many ways cultivated a form of expertise, right, of the way in which we should think about and talk about drugs differently than were policymakers or clinicians or the basic scientists who I was following. So I got very caught up in that movement, in the history of that movement, and in trying to tell the story of that movement as a movement specifically around intervention of science, bystander science, street science, however you want to talk about that. And so a lot of my recent work has been in that direction.
Yeah, so I've always really been kind of fascinated about how science sort of follows behind harm reduction in a lot of instances. It's like people who use drugs are very smart, very innovative, and they know a lot of the time what's happening to their bodies, especially historically, more than a lot of public health officials and doctors and that kind of thing. And I think we're seeing that happen again in real time. The drug supply is shifting yet again and to more and more unpredictable territory, especially with contaminants like xylazine, which, I mean, we can even get into the discussion of whether it's a contaminant or not. I think that's a really important thing to unpack. But it's really interesting and that you're doing this history and you're following this kind of stuff, because it's a history that doesn't get told well very much. The whole aspect of nothing about us without us. A lot of times, drug users, people who use drugs, are excluded from telling their own stories or giving their perspective on this stuff. And I think you've done a really good job in your career of amending that mistake.
Well, thank you. I think that making knowledge is something that, particularly when you're talking about, quote, human subjects, making knowledge is something that has to happen between the researcher and the researched, and that oftentimes a more participatory knowledge making can yield, in fact, better science. So what was interesting, and I'll just tell you a little bit about the place at Lexington, these doctors, they didn't know anything about opioid addiction or any what it would mean to use these drugs, and they were trying to figure it out. And because they were the first people in the world to be trying to figure it out, it was the world's first dedicated laboratory simply to studying this issue, which was called the opium problem in the 1920s, when the effort to try to bring science to bear on the problem began. It began actually in New York City. And it began the New York Bureau of Social Hygiene, where there were a fair number of heroin users who were, and morphine users, who began to kind of shape what the street scene there was like. And they were the people who ended up being shipped to Lexington for treatment. And so that's an interesting thing, because they were often quite experienced, well-seasoned people who really knew, they knew dope, they knew their stuff. And the doctors and physicians and researchers didn't. And so they had to be in conversation in the lab. The lab was a research ward. And in particular, they talked a lot about social cues. They talked about that they would have an urge, a longing, really, to relapse when they saw certain places or certain people, so people, places, and things. And so they brought that into the laboratory and they studied it. They studied how social and environmental cues enter into a drug user's and memory. And so they got very interested in the people, because they understood drug users as smart, as seasoned, as knowledgeable. About 10 to 15% of their patients at any given time were doctors and nurses. They were healthcare professionals who simply had access and used it. And so I think that that model, we're now seeing a bit more of the return of that kind of model. I think for a very long time, there was a kind of clinical trials approach that did not really allow for drug users to be making knowledge together with physicians and scientists. I think actually we would have known more about the overdose situation had we listened earlier in the trajectory of the science of overdose. So the science of overdose is particularly interesting because, of course, it's very difficult to study people who are in an overdose situation if they're in an emergent setting. And so there has been a gradual, well, how do we study overdose? And you know, kind of a return to, let's listen to what people say. And not simply see our human subjects as people we're working on, but rather people we're working with.
Yeah, Nancy, it's interesting, the discussion on overdose and when it sort of became noticeably problematic. I mean, I was looking at a chart. I went back to Brecher's original piece yesterday, I guess, when I was preparing for this. And if you look at a chart through the century, it's really just very, very few overdoses up until, I guess, about the 69, maybe they start climbing up, or maybe a couple years before that. And then there's just a huge spike in the early 70s. And of course, Edward Brecher wrote that it was nearly impossible to overdose on heroin, and that they've done studies that seasoned heroin users could, you know, one guy used like 9 times as a, you know, a normal dose or something, and didn't even get sick. What do you think? Can you unpack that a little bit? What was going on there back in the 70s when we had sort of our first, what they said was an epidemic? And I think there was about 5,000 overdoses nationally that year.
Yeah, so it's pretty interesting to me because there were many, many years when overdose did not show up. And that's partly because doctors wouldn't write it on a death certificate. You have to think of death certification as a social process. And oftentimes doctors would not record overdose as a cause of death, even if they clearly thought it was, because it was so stigmatized that family members wouldn't accept it essentially as a cause of death. So there's that problem. There's the problem of hidden overdose, which I think was actually larger than we give it credit for, but that was typically people who were pretty ill and who, quote, died in their sleep. So that there's that problem. But the fact is, and it is pretty interesting, that we have plenty of morphine and heroin users, and post-World War II, we have plenty of heroin injectors, but we don't have overdose deaths at anything like levels that really show up, except in New York City. And in New York City, we have a medical examiner, Milton Halpern, who is very interested, for personal reasons in some ways, in heroin overdose deaths. And he becomes the world's leading authority on heroin overdose deaths. And so it is to him that Edward Brecker, when he's writing Licit and Illicit Drugs, the Consumer Union's Guide to Licit and Illicit Drugs, which comes out in 1972 and was pretty familiar to a lot of people I knew. I mean, it was how you learned about drugs, was this book. So Brecker was very skeptical that heroin overdose, was possible because the heroin supply was so bad. And there were so many what they called in those days adulterants, we would call maybe additives. But, you know, what heroin was cut with was, very problematic. So there used to be a lot of emphasis in New York City on pulmonary edema. So overdose deaths that included frothing at the mouth, this kind of white froth that would be photographed obsessively, right? Those were the photographs that would appear in Milton Halpern's, his presentations about overdose and how to ascertain that a death was an overdose, because there was a lot of mystery about that. And there were also other health conditions like cellulitis and endocarditis that kind of followed, and hepatitis that followed along with overdose, and that were often also kind of confounding the mix. So the other problem with overdose was, and we keep, this is a perpetual, this is an aspect of amnesia. This is constantly, we forget this. But even in the 50s and 60s, two thirds of the overdose deaths that occurred in this country, in the UK, for instance, were from barbiturates, not opioids. And there was frequent mixing. So one of the problems with the term overdose is it implies that there's one substance that is overdosed, right? That there's some sort of universal standard dose. And then there's one substance that's overdose, and that creates the lethality. What actually created the lethality and still does is what we would maybe call polydrug. In my book, I call it the lethal synergies of polydrug use, because it's alcohol, ethanol. It was really a kind of fiction that people who used heroin didn't also drink. And then also barbiturates and other sedatives, because there became increasingly large numbers of sedatives on the market. Production quotas were, huge. I often wonder why you should have David Hertzberg on Narcotica to talk about the massive amount of sedatives and hypnotics, right, that were circulating in American life. So the polydrug problem is a real one, because people might be said to have died of a heroin overdose, but they actually were drinking and had barbiturates in their system. George Gay, the physician at the Haight-Ashbury Clinic, did a study in the 60s of heroin. They had a lot of regular users of heroin who came into the clinic, and he found that 37% of them used barbiturates to sleep, and 25% of them drank also to sleep. And so I think that the problem of thinking about opioids as the main mechanism of overdose, right, is, really an overdose is the announced result of the co-presence of alcohol, benzodiazepines, opioids, and like today, xylazine. And people are using all of those things intentionally, or fentanyl. People are intentionally using these things. They are not accidentally, unintentionally, running into them. But there are, of course, adulterants or additives that people are not intending to use or don't even know are there. And that is what confounds the historical overdose picture. It's a very impure world, and one in which there's very rarely been purity. And so overdose is a kind of, as somebody who has tried to write a history of overdose, it's really hard to define. It's hard to find in pure form. And it also carries the connotation of acute, right? And not not chronic. And so for a long, long time, nobody is thinking you could do anything about overdose. And nobody is thinking you have time, right, to act. Some of the earliest studies of overdose prevention and naloxone, bystander naloxone, have to establish that there is time to act, because everyone thinks overdose is an acute thing. You overdose, you know, you can't breathe, you die. And so overdose makes it seem almost as if the person who overdoses is already dead, socially dead, because it's a moral category. It carries a moral charge.
That is a level of nuance that I think is so hard to convey sometimes, that it's really not an opioid overdose crisis. It's a polydrug overdose crisis. I don't know if there's a better term than overdose that people can use, but yeah, I've had a lot of friends that have died from overdose. And, you know, when you look at their medical reports or the autopsy or whatever, it's usually fentanyl and meth or some other kind of alcohol is a big one.
Yeah, I think the alcohol is really underrepresented. The amount of people that drank, and it was around the time I read the Brecker piece that I was interviewing some old heads in New York, kind of, and they said it was common practice for them to use the cap from a Thunderbird wine, their cooker, and then wine, and that just clicked all around, you know. And I thought, wow, that's a trend that happened that probably led to an increase in overdoses, and also probably the launch of the war on drugs by Nixon. You know, made it more politically viable for the administration, I guess, to show the dangers of drugs. And I wonder how much but go ahead, Fred.
Yeah, that Nixonian moment is a really interesting one to me, because the creation of separate they ultimately don't become NIH institutes until almost the 1990s, but the creation of separate institutes, right? Alcohol is separate from drug abuse, as it was called at the time. And so you have this kind of, it really does help solidify this idea that drug users don't drink and that drinkers don't do drugs. And it's nonsensical when you really think about, talk to anyone and you would understand that there isn't this kind of harsh kind of division between the two. And so overdose in a lot of ways is pretty misleading because it could as well be, you know, considered a death from alcohol. It's really interesting. The old 19th century categories, which were much more so they would talk about poisoning or they would talk about accident. They were much less substance specific. We have this very formal, formulaic way, almost algorithmic way of assigning cause of death. And we look at the percentages of different things that are, present, et cetera. Initially in the 50s, 60s, when Milton Halpern, for instance, is trying to figure out how do we figure out what an overdose death is, how do we classify them? There was, again, that fiction, right, that there was not overlap between alcohol and, in those days, barbiturates, in our day, benzodiazepines and opioids. But frankly, people are looking for comfort and they are finding it in lots of different places. And many of those overwhelm the system with sedative effect. And that means that respiratory depression sets in. We are lucky, yeah, to have naloxone to reverse respiratory depression in the case of opioids. But we also, and we suspect that there might be some effect on benzodiazepines, but certainly not on alcohol. And so there are lots of interesting reasons to be pursuing research to look further for more effective antidotes. Part of the story that I try to tell in OD is, you know, for many, many years, you know, centuries, drugs were thought to have antidotes, right? The idea for a long time was that there were specific antidotes for each drug. And for opioids, there's a whole long list of antidotes from belladonna to, you know, just crazy ice water, of course, being the famous one, and milk. Sometimes that pulmonary edema that Milton Halpern would find as a result of quinine or other mix-ins would be attributed to drug users trying to help each other by administering antidotes like milk or ice water or something like this. And, you know, some of the earliest antidotes, pain, right, was thought to be the real antidote to a morphine overdose. There's an instance that I write about in the book of a physician who invents a torture device, a thumb screw device that he uses to successfully revive someone, he says, from a morphine overdose, right? Because that is thought, it is thought that pain is the thing that will, you know, so again, the moral picture is very clear here. You know, the antagonist, and I did just recently listen to another Narcotica podcast that you did with someone on naltrexone, and the idea that pain is redemptive and that antagonists, opioid antagonists, are somehow a kind of penance, a kind of redemption. You know, that if you go through withdrawal, that you don't get any enjoyment, right, out of an antagonist, that is somehow morally redemptive of your character. So I think in this domain, whenever we're thinking about overdose, we have to think about the moral sort of, it's a moral category as well as it's a scientific or clinical way to differentiate a death.
Yes. Yeah, I agree with that. And I wonder if there's a more precise term we can use than overdose, because it's just not that great for the reasons you describe. But also, it seems like the definition of overdose is changing as the drug supply is changing. People are presenting differently, and that's resulting in you have to respond differently. I hear that a lot from the harm reduction groups. It's like people are overdosing on these, they call it trank dope, the xylazine. And they're like, well, you respond to this differently than you would an opioid overdose, or even overamping on stimulants or something like that. And Chris, you should jump in here, because I think you know a lot more about this than me. But
yeah, well, the xylazine is we're still kind of figuring it out, but it doesn't seem to be like a benzodiazepine where it potentiates. It's literally a separate, like, high. It's not even a high. It's somebody's asleep. They're snoring, sound asleep. So yeah, I mean, the prevention point here, they've had to retrain their entire staff recognizing when somebody is out on drank versus in respiratory disease.
Yeah, and I think it's always the harm reductionists who are seeing people in that moment who should be listened to, should be understood as when naloxone initially was, brought into emergency medicine. Emergency medicine was very new. And actually in Pittsburgh, the people who kind of invented emergency medicine, Nancy Caroline, wrote a textbook about how to titrate naloxone. Right. They never thought that there was a 4, you know, milligram dose of naloxone, and that was all there was. They said you have to try some, see what happens, try some more. You have to titrate it because you don't know how tolerant was this person. You don't know how much this person has used or what exactly they have used. And so I think that's another problem with overdose. It's misleading because it implies that there's a kind of universal body response, standardized response. And what harm reduction really is do away with the standard and actually reply to what's happening what's actually happening in the situation. Because what's an overdose for a non-opioid tolerant individual will not be an overdose for somebody who is tolerant to opioids. Tolerance is a neuroadaptation, right? So it, what we don't know, I think, is what's, is there tolerance and what does it mean with something like xylazine, right? We, this was kind of the mistake that was made by a lot of scientists of overdose, was thinking that other drugs would behave like opioids. And we had to learn that no, there are different kinds of responses. And if you talk to people who use these drugs, they have different kinds of experiences and different kinds of effects. And they can tell you, they can give you valuable information if you have a way to listen to them. And I think that's what harm reduction really is. It's a way of listening to drug users and a way of understanding and channeling that knowledge in a way that's very different from what you would find in a clinical lab kind of setup.
Can we talk a little bit about the current state of naloxone? I mean, you have this really great book that really gets into, you know, the whole history of it and everything, but I believe it came out 2 or 3 years ago, and a lot has changed since then, especially at the FDA. Thankfully, they finally realized, oh, wow, we can make this over-the-counter and the sky's not going to fall. But that does introduce some new problems, of course, number one being access. Just because you make naloxone over-the-counter doesn't really make a big difference if you're making it really expensive. And
I don't think we're really going to see it till the early next year. So, yeah.
I'd like to just say that I saw my first reversal back in 1993. So naloxone's been used for quite a while. But it was I didn't know what the EMTs were doing. But in retrospect, that's what, yeah. So I think it was just more recently that somebody formulated this drug into a patent
Okay. So I can tell you a little bit about that. Naloxone is a FDA approved in 1971 for the purpose of opioid reversal, right? Overdose reversal. And what's interesting is that there was a predecessor drug called nalerfine, which is dysphoric and difficult, but does reverse opioid overdose, the respiratory depression part of opioid overdose. And that was actually on, you know, emergency medical vehicles. Nalerfine was on those trucks in the beginning. Naloxone wasn't out on those trucks until the mid-1970s, until a little bit later than it would look from its approval, but it was in use in certain places, especially Pittsburgh. So the Pittsburgh story, right, is one in which Freedom House, the African-American ambulance company that Peter Zafar, you know, co-founder of CPR and airway maintenance, that they had naloxone and they did, they used it, you know, they've been using it since the 1970s. And as it began to get into, you know, more and more use, you have places like Haight-Ashbury, you have places where people realize what it is and figure out how to get it from paramedics, generally, divert it. From paramedics or from hospice or other places, and figure out how to use it. But that is a slow kind of knowledge kind of building up. And so in the 1990s, I think you see that in many different places, including in like rural New Mexico, right, where people are reading army manuals and realize. So there were ideas that there should be naloxone kits in army manuals in very early 1950s. And there were early uses of naloxone kind of episodically. But nobody thought, oh, wait a second, these harm reduction people are very close to drug users who might need naloxone. Nobody thought of bystander naloxone until a lot later. Of, you know, the idea of equipping people and, you know, getting naloxone out But, you know, what's interesting, when Edward Brecker wrote that book, Licit and Illicit Drugs, published in 1972, he wrote that the death of anyone due to heroin overdose should be very rarely excusable. And he was writing about nalorphine because he knew that there was an antidote. He knew there was something that you could do. And so in 1972, even after the approval of naloxone, he is saying, look, people shouldn't be dying of heroin overdose because we have an antidote. And what we have to do is figure out how to get, you know, people where they should be so that they, you know, can be essentially reversed. So naloxone, and I'll tell you, when the scientists, so harm reduction had to create an evidence base to say that naloxone actually worked and that bystanders, people who didn't have any, quote, medical training, could reverse an overdose. And actually, the overdose prevention movement started, they didn't even really center naloxone at first. At first, it was rescue breathing. It was put people in rescue position. It was maybe do chest compressions, right? Naloxone comes into the overdose prevention space because people are realizing that, yeah, this really does it. And we really need to figure out channels, right, for getting this out to people. Naloxone is a very, you know, pharmacologists call it clean. It's a very clear antagonist, right? It will bump off opioids that are sitting on those receptors, and nothing, you know, will, but it's short acting. So a lot of the research that's going on is about a longer acting naloxone. Could there be a longer acting naloxone? Could there be a naloxone? You know, so that a lot of what you're seeing now is experimentation around, well, okay, how can we make this so that people don't slump back into respiratory depression after they've been administered naloxone? It took a very long time for harm reduction activists to bring to the attention of public health authorities the need for naloxone. And they had to do it state by state, and they had to get laws to change in every single state. Naloxone access laws, you know, could you give somebody an injection? Could you? The nasal product was actually I'm going to call it a jerry-rigged product that was created by EMTs and harm reduction activists, you know, by putting together something else that they administered nasally. They decided to try this with naloxone, so they did that. And then the companies get into the game, right? Then all of this, naloxone's an old drug. It was off patent. It was invented in the 60s, and it was off patent, and it was cheap at first. It was cheap to harm reductionists when Dan Bigg and Chicago Recovery Alliance created a national clearinghouse for naloxone distribution. They could buy it very cheaply. That was the injectable product. But as, you know, capitalism goes, you get companies that are trying to, you know, they basically patent the delivery mechanism. So the nasal delivery mechanism, that is what we now call Narcan. Narcan initially was injectable naloxone, but now it's, you know, this Invidior's nasal naloxone, intranasal naloxone. Now, the problem with all of that is that it does drive the price up. And so the FDA, again, very slow. I think the feds, I think everybody lagged behind on this, right? The people who made overdose a public problem, right, took it out of the shadows of private problem and made it a public problem, are the people who noticed their friends overdosing, or people who overdosed themselves, or people who noticed that people were overdosing more often. And they did something about it, right? They figured out how to get naloxone out. And then they figured out that there are researchers who will help them produce an evidence base for the public health authorities that needed to have evidence before they would invest in naloxone as a public health measure. And so, you know, those folks, they began to liberate naloxone, which had been confined completely to the medical enclave, to the ER, to the OR, and to emergency response. And they got it out. And they came up with creative ways to get naloxone out. When the researchers first went to NIDA to get funds to study whether bystander intervention would work, you know, they were denied. Overdose was not thought to be a scientifically sweet problem. It wasn't a real issue. It took many years for them to kind of break that and break into some funding to produce the evidence that naloxone worked. Now, this sounds silly to us, right? Because of course naloxone works. We've seen it work, right? We know it works. This is how it works. There isn't, you know, that much that can be done about that, but they had to produce the evidence that people who didn't have medical training could administer it and still save lives. You know, and that kind of public education, public health education that harm reduction movement has really invested in, that is really quite heroic because, as I said, they had to do it state by state and they have to do it in very local and often absolutely, you know, it takes everything that people have to get the situation to turn around to create what it is today. So,
yeah, they not only had to do all this work and lay the groundwork for everything, they also risked arrest, you know, standing out long enough ago and saying, I'm a drug user and you need to respect my rights as a human being, puts a big target on you. And I just got to say, it's not really surprising to me that government institutions for decades knew that naloxone worked. Like you said, the Army was clear they knew this worked. This is before the FDA even approved it as a medication. And at any point, they could have been like, oh, people who use drugs are overdosing and dying. It wasn't until it started hitting a certain amount of death, literally so many bodies piled up that they can't ignore it. And then they're like, oh, yeah, I guess we'll make this like a Good Samaritan law kind of thing or whatever. And now finally, in 2023, the FDA has made naloxone over-the-counter, and it's still not even, as far as I can tell, in stores yet, which is just like, this is just speaks to the broader truth that nobody gives a shit about people who use drugs. Like, until it's literally a public health emergency that's so big, we can't ignore it anymore. And that's just so frustrating, but it's also so typical. And it's not just opioids. It's every single drug that isn't under, like, a sanctioned list, namely alcohol and tobacco. And we had public interventions for those, too. Yeah, so can we talk a little bit more about the present day and the way that things are shaping up with the FDA that keeps approving these new naloxone formulations, which, like you said, is just capitalism at work. You're not creating anything new. You're not doing anything innovative. You're just making, oh, you put in a nasal spray. I mean, they did that with ketamine. You know, there's all kinds of examples of drugs like that. It's just a way of repackaging and shifting patents around and laundering money. Well, not laundering, but accumulating wealth.
I think maybe you may have misspoke. It was Adapt that came out with the first nasal spray, correct? Or not Indivior, Nancy?
Yeah.
It was Adapt, right? Yeah. So, right, and as Troy was saying, now we're seeing this sort of, well, in Philadelphia, they wouldn't, the harm reduction groups wouldn't give it out injectables. So, so it was like, there was this real, like, dearth of naloxone in 2017 when I first started covering full-time the overdose crisis. So we would go to New York and get the injectables with the little cap on the top, right? Like the nasal adapter, which would have been fine, you know, and just bring them back. But
yeah, I mean, I think there's a moral code in that as well. There just has been so, it's kind of like medication-assisted treatment. You know, this idea that you're going to give drug users drugs. For some reason, that injectable naloxone made everyone very nervous because, my God, you need a needle. And, you know, needles, that will just produce, I don't know, more need for more needles. And so it's been very interesting to watch the moral coding around the intranasal product versus injectable. It's been, you know, very clear that public health officials do not want injectable because they don't want people seeing people inject other people, because injection, you know, it's a moral coding.
In spite of the fact that it would be cheaper. But there are all these new products coming out now. You know, you mentioned the short time frame of naloxone. So I guess it's nalamphine, or I'm not sure if I'm saying it right, that the FDA just approved that that's supposed to have a 10-hour window. There's a 3 milligram.
Right, right, right. And the there will be new or sort of delivery mechanisms. I've heard of one that will just go through the skin, right? So there will be no needles. It'll just, you know, just go right through the skin. So anyway, it's very maddening to me, because if just regular naloxone would have to be much more available to actually make a dent in that curve. That is what's happened with overdose deaths, is that since 1979, they have increased 9% a year. And that has just kept going. That explains our present. And so halfway through that, like 20 years into that 40-year curve, that's when harm reduction notices the overdose increase. And that's when people could have done something about it and kind of, you know, I mean, yes, harm reductionists have been working, you know, round the clock in many instances to get something to happen there. Only since 2017, right? So FDA in 2017, the FDA took the very unusual step. I'm not sure it has been done in any other case, of saying, they called on pharmaceutical companies to propose to take naloxone over the counter. That's called the OTC switch space. You take a drug that is behind the counter and you make it an over-the-counter drug. And they even incentivized it. They did many of the initial studies. They didn't do all of the studies. They, you know, companies had to come forward with proposals to, you know, create an OTC product. So what happened, just happened this year, right? You have two companies, profit-motivated Emergent BioSolutions enters the nasal spray naloxone market. And they expect that the naloxone market, by the way, will be a $1 billion market by 2027. So that's why they're in this. But the nonprofit, Harm Reduction Therapeutics, who worked with Prevention Point Pittsburgh, they also just got approved, just a few months later, got approved for a genuinely cheap, affordable naloxone product. So what I'm interested in is what are our drugstore shelves going to look like in early 2024? What is that? Because I don't think Emergent BioSolutions is, you know, maybe they'll have a $20 product, but like, who can really afford a $20 over-the-counter naloxone product? So I think that there will be, now that Harm Reduction Therapeutics is in it, there will be the attempts to bring the price down finally, because there's really genuinely been no, you know, sometimes capitalists, they talk about how much they love competition, but then they just, you know, don't allow for it. And so now we'll see, you know, we'll get to see what really happens. But I also think that there's new novel. So one of the real reasons to be the opposition to the Halt Fentanyl Act in Congress has been, you know, by Cory Booker and others, is because to make fentanyl a Schedule I drug, first of all, is impossible medically, because it's a medically necessary drug. We've all had it for all kinds of stuff. And but secondly, because it would mean that research on fentanyl and fentanyl analogs, including the possibility of whatever the next naloxone is going to be, will not be done, because some of those fentanyl analogs act like antagonists. And so there's really a lot of reason to, you know, oppose that In addition to all of the usual reasons of, you know, why would we further criminalize something when we have seen how poorly criminalization works and how negatively it affects drug users and drug using communities.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's such a hard argument to make sometimes, because it's like, okay, yeah, you see fentanyl and its analogs being really deadly, but they do have medical value. I think most drugs do, even thalidomide. Like, that's one that's just like billed as a poison, but there are reasons to prescribe everything, like in certain contexts. And there are, as all these clandestine chemists are coming up with new formulations to get around laws and stuff like that, yeah, they keep trying to schedule this stuff, and it is setting back science. I mean, you really only have to look at the cannabis and psychedelic research and how often they are just like set back by these archaic laws of scheduling, and it is really frustrating, because yeah, just because there's a fentanyl analog out there that's causing a lot of damage on the streets doesn't mean that it can't be reined in and used pharmaceutically.
No, it's well, I have a question for you guys, because I'm kind of interested in the new register that I'm hearing of drug overdose as poisoning. And you know, that obviously signals the need for safe supply, and we obviously have safe supply in the case of many legal pharmaceuticals, right? So we're good at drug safety and we're good at safe supply. We just don't do it in this arena because we don't have the political will to do it in this arena. So I'm curious about that, and whether you're hearing the idea of drug poisoning, whether that is a kind of liberatory register that's been helpful for bringing attention to the need for safe supply, or whether that is just another scary scare tactic that won't work.
I actually did a presentation on this for the Philadelphia Poison Control Center. And at the time, I mean, there was something of a debate among, let's say, progressive thinkers on drug about the language, and this kind of started here in Philadelphia in 2018, when there was an outbreak of numerous corners that had adulterated their fentanyl with synthetic cannabinoid, because there was a belief that it would make the legs last longer for the fentanyl, and a lot of things, and that's really where xylazine comes in behind that. But you know, I used the term poisoning. It was in the piece I wrote about it, and another local journalist used the term overdose, and we got in a little debate, and that grew out, you know, into, and I looked back in the literature, you know, in the 90s there was a scopolamine outbreak in, I think, in New York, and the New York Times used the term poisoning throughout, you know, and I think overdose does carry this stigmatizing connotation that A, you know the dose to begin with, and B, you're being irresponsible and taking too much of it.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, people say, well, poisoning implies a poisoner, which then goes to the, you know, the higher sentencing and all that goes with fentanyl, and many of these people that are trapping on the streets, what they're selling, in what quantities and securities, and they're the ones that are getting scooped up in these drug induced homicide causes and such. So, but yeah, it's really a double edged sword, and I can see both sides of it. But I would say that in many cases, certainly when I broke the Trank story here in Philadelphia in 2019, people were not taking something they did not like. I mean, they noticed it. I learned about that from drug users. And so if you're forced to take something that you don't want in your product, what another word there is for it, it's certainly not responsibility, it's certainly not the fault of the person that sells it.
Right.
I've heard from a lot of people in harm reduction to avoid the term drug poisoning, because like Chris said, it kind of like shifts the responsibility. There's like a racial component too, you know, these poor white kids that are dying and overdosing, oh, they were poisoned, like they didn't know better, that kind of thing. And that narrative serves a certain power structure, and it does lead to you can kind of see this, like laws being passed that are drug homicide laws. If you sell something to somebody else and you don't know what's in it and they die, it's like, oh, it's a drug poisoning, therefore you should be charged with manslaughter or murder. I mean, I think we can all agree that doesn't help the situation. And it's difficult to be, because I see what people are trying to convey with the poisoning narrative, because you have a drug supply that is unpredictable and deadly. But at the same time, you can't have blanket terms like that either. Some people, they don't want xylazine in their dope. And when they get that, you know, if they overdose on xylazine, it's an unintentional thing. But there are people out there that actually do seek it out, as Chris just mentioned. There are people that, you know, when fentanyl started coming onto the scene, nobody really wanted that. But there are people that do literally seek out fentanyl.
For sure now in Philadelphia, it's universal. You know, fentanyl is the drug.
Yeah. I myself, having had a medical procedure where the fentanyl sort of kicked in after the procedure was done, I can see it. You know, I actually, when I first, began hearing and reading about that, I thought, oh, there are going to be people who are primarily seeking fentanyl. I can't imagine there wouldn't be. And so I think it's we're living through a time when there's a lot of ambivalence about how to respond. And sometimes the language of poisoning sounds to me like a, think about your poison control center. Yuck. You know, it's an attempt to make all of the product yucky. And I still remember those little stickers when I was, I grew up in Philadelphia and we had little poison control stickers all over the place. And, it was a thing, poison has its attractions to some people. And most people just see that as somehow deviant behavior, right? Whereas those of us who have a prescription and go to the drugstore for our poison, we can guarantee, right? Or we think we can guarantee that there's not going to be anything in that that's going to kill us. And so I wonder a lot about market structure changes and whether we should be thinking about, if we're thinking about safe supply, we ought to be thinking about safe markets, how to make markets safer. And harm reductionists have done that, right? They're thinking about how to reduce the harm of this kind of market. But I think maybe we should think more about what we mean by, how can we do a better job of guaranteeing the safety of these products? Because it's pretty clear that we've gone in the opposite direction. We have made as dangerous, a market scenario as we possibly can. Again, to come full circle with the history, accidental overdose was the way these poisonings first entered the lexicon back in the 19th century. And there are many instances of accidental overdoses occurring. I looked at the New York Times and its predecessors for any stories that had anything to do with this. And most of them were considered accidental. And they were situations where, you know, a kid is sent to the drugstore to bring his mother the morphine that she, who is terminally ill, needs. And she takes it all at once instead of in grains. And so she accidentally dies. She did intend to take it, but she did not intend to die. And I think that's another thing that's out there in the ether, is that, people are not intending to die. People who are users are not intending to die. In fact, they're attempting to avoid death by using something that helps them to keep safe and comfortable and keep them from death. And so I think this current situation does seem to me like a public health. And I've not always been I'm a bit of a critic of public health in certain ways. It took a very long time for public health to become concerned with overdose. And now that they are concerned, now that public health departments and everyone is concerned, I think it's more important than ever to get across the idea to people that overdose is local. So, you happen to be in Philadelphia, Chris, which, you know, at first, right, xylazine is very confined. And this is often the case, right? Fentanyl, you know, was fairly local to the Northeast for quite a while. And so in the beginnings, when harm reduction is, when people are beginning to see practices and patterns start to show up, we should listen to them rather than painting everything as if it's a national epidemic. It's more of a, these things are always micro local at first. And that's where we see them first. And that was certainly the case with fentanyl in 2005, 6, 7. We saw particular clusters, right? And so it seems like, yeah, we should be thinking very local. And that is going to be the way that we respond to overdose, because it's always at the very local level, I think, these things begin.
What are you working on now, Nancy?
Oh, boy. You know, I keep trying to get away from drugs. So I've actually been interested in the Department of Justice is starting to sue employers who either unlawfully terminate or discipline people who are on maintenance, either buprenorphine or methadone. They want them to be on naltrexone, but they, you know, that's not always the best for the individual or for the, the health of the person. And so I've been looking at these cases. So I've been, you know, following the various sort of histories of methadone, buprenorphine, and naltrexone. And so I'm thinking about that. And I'm always thinking interested in what harm reduction is up to. So I follow that. And narcofeminisms is this new kind of way of bringing together some of my older work on gender and addiction. And so there's a whole narco-feminist movement in Central and Eastern Europe. And so I've written a piece actually with an artist, Jamie Harari, who's on Instagram at hashtag Celestial Heartbreak. And so I've written a bit about her sort of harm reduction art, because I think harm reduction is becoming an expressive social movement. It's always been an expressive social movement. It's just that now there's more of it. And so I've been following that. I'm always one step behind harm reduction because I think that's where I should be. I'm a historian. And although I sometimes call myself a historian of the present, I'm really very interested in this market question and fentanyl and how one would even begin to write history of fentanyl is yet to be seen.
Yeah, I mean, it maybe is kind of silly to ask a historian about the future, but I do have that question. Indivior is just one of these companies that sees like this market opportunity as the drug crisis gets worse, and they seem to be throwing any antagonist they can at the wall to see if it sticks and becomes another blockbuster. There's a Wall Street Journal article that just came out recently, if you don't mind me quoting it. Pharmaceutical company Indivior has completed a clinical trial for nasal spray that people could take before a night on the town, make them want to drink less than usual. Quote, I arrive in the parking lot. I don't want 6 or 7 drinks. I'll top it off with a nasal spray, says CEO Mark Crosley, laying out a use case for the product. The drug, which is, drumroll, naltrexone, works on opioid receptors in the brain's reward system and blocks the pleasant effects of alcohol. Indivior wants to make a short-acting version of naltrexone that works within 5 minutes, says Christian Heidbrader, the company's chief scientific officer. And I also did some reporting for Salon about Indivior developing a drug to reverse cannabis overdoses. Since late 2018, the California-based biotech has also been developing a cannabinoid called Drinabant into a treatment for THC overdose, but also cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome, a mysterious condition in which marijuana users suddenly become violently ill. But there is good reason to believe Drynabant may be extremely toxic. So I'm not really not sure what they're thinking. Indivior would not respond to my request for comment. And so I wonder, you know, this is sort of a trend. We're going to see more of these antagonists kind of try to come onto the market, I think. But do you think that the lessons from naloxone can be applied to their development?
That's a very interesting question. So now Trexone, you know, there's always been this understanding. So pharmacologists, the behavioral pharmacologists who I studied when I was writing Discovering Addiction, they thought that naltrexone was going to end their work, right? They thought this is the be all end all because it's a perfect, pharmacologically perfect antagonist. And obviously that wasn't the case because society and what is socially acceptable and what people will, what individuals will actually take, tolerate, or desire is very much not something like these deterrent drugs, right? People are looking for something other than, you know, deterrence. So I think that the market for antagonists is limited. I think that because historically, I think that because naltrexone has been so limited. But I also think this is really interesting because in this space, right, we only have three drugs that are used as addiction therapeutic drugs. When somebody wants to stop using an opioid, they can go on methadone, which is an agonist, or they can go on buprenorphine, which is a partial agonist antagonist, or naltrexone. And that's all. In all these decades, right, there has been very little innovation in this space. And so it's pretty interesting that now that, you know, harm reductionists have gotten naloxone to be, you know, public, that now we're going to have all suddenly all of this innovation in this sector. And I think that we're going to see the recycling of a lot of these sort of moral condemnations and a lot of these, I mean, you can't help but think of what was once called pharmacological Calvinism, right? How to help people just not do drugs. And, you know, just throw everything at them and see what sticks. I think that's exactly right. And it will be very interesting to see if they can make a profit from drugs that people don't really want. That will be interesting.
Yeah, I cringe when I hear the word, you know, vaccine, like a fentanyl vaccine or, I mean, it's just like, I just imagine that, you know, every child now being, you know, inoculated against pleasure of any kind, which is
yeah, that's really, I really agree with you there, Chris. I had a behavioral pharmacologist friend working on so when NIDA started its medications development division in 1990, they concentrated on cocaine antagonists and they concentrated on buprenorphine. And you know, buprenorphine had long been, actually buprenorphine testing began at the narcotic farm in Lexington, Kentucky, and continued when they moved to Baltimore and became the intramural research program of NIDA. So there's, you know, just been a lot of, you know, this notion of vaccination, right, is actually, I think what they're looking for is enzymes that can eat up the cocaine before it affects you. You know how fast cocaine affects you. And so it's a very interesting, strange ambition to me. And I do think that it's problematic because, of course, people do drugs because they are seeking satisfaction, comfort, pleasure. They're seeking something that they lack in their lives. And so they're having it this way. And so what does it mean that we go after? I think it's very concerning. I mean, even the things that deep brain stimulation and transcranial magnetic resonance, all of those sort of things that are being now used, explored as potential kind of deterrence to doing drugs or as in a sense to as vaccines. I think these are very problematic, and it's not just because I just think everything should be natural, but because I think that this is a level of interference in neuroadaptation that we could come to regret.
I agree with you. And I actually interviewed Dr. Nora Valkoff at NIDA a couple of months ago, and I asked her about the vaccine question. And she told me that it's not really, they're not seeing much success with the research. It's kind of stalling, and they're actually focusing more on monoclonal antibodies, which is a interesting approach that's sort of, that was, I don't know if it is anymore, monoclonal antibodies used to treat COVID, but I think the new strains of COVID, like, stopped being stopped immunely, you know what I mean? So it is like a really interesting question that they're trying to answer with this research, but I can't help but feel like it's a huge waste of research dollars when we could be spending that money on something like, you know, proving that safe supply works. I mean, I guess there's not enough evidence there to really like roll it out, but like, or supervised consumption sites, or there's a thousand things I can think of that when it comes to drug policy, I would like to see more money thrown out rather than vaccines or monoclonal antibodies. I think there's just so much better ways to focus our energy.
Yeah, I agree with you on the sort of science fiction aspects. The money that goes into addiction neuroscience, I think, is a bit criminal when we have plenty of evidence showing that there are no overdose deaths in these supervised consumption sites. So why aren't we building harm reduction infrastructure? Why aren't we redirecting public dollars into things that we know actually help people live instead of these kind of science fiction therapies that will definitely profit pharmaceutical companies, but which may not really actually help people and could do harm.
Yeah, totally. I think this is a good place to wrap up. Nancy, where can people find you on social media or online?
Oh, boy. So I mainly do personal social media. So I'm on Instagram at NancyCampbell6882, I think. But I mainly, it's my books and articles and my website at my university, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. You can find me on email at Campbell, CAMPBELL, at rpi.edu. And that's probably the best way to find me.
I'm glad we finally got a chance to catch up, Nancy. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Great to talk with both of you.
Thanks for listening to Narcotica, an independent production by Narcomedia. Co-hosted and co-produced by Zachary Siegel, Troy Farah, Christopher Maraff, and Aaron Ferguson. I'm your co-producer, Aaron Ferguson. If you like the show, you can find out more at narcocast.com and support us by joining our Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/narcotica. We are excited to announce that a portion of the proceeds from the show will now go toward the Urban Survivors Union, which is the National Drug Users Union, a group of directly impacted advocates for drug user health in America. This is the way social change happens from the ground up, and we are so excited to support this group that is doing such important work to fight stigma against people who use drugs. If you're a patron, you also get free stickers which are personally mailed to you. You can also request a shout out on the show. And now, patrons can even get 30% off of merch in our new store, which is at narcocast.myshopify.com. We have t-shirts and coffee mugs, one that says, "There are drugs in here," which is awesome. More stuff will be added soon. As always, we are so grateful to the folks that make this show possible. A little goes a long way, so thanks for making Narcotica happen. We're ad-free, and we want to keep it that way. If Patreon just isn't for you, that's fine. You can help us out by spreading the word. Tell all your friends about the podcast, advocating for social justice and abolishing the drug war. can also rate us wherever you get your podcasts. Our theme music is by Glass Boy, and Jenny Shea is the voice of Narcotica. Additional music is by myself, alias Nomad1, drug using producer. Well, I guess that's all. I hope you guys have a great rest of your day. Until next time.